From KCUR News, this is KC Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is away this week. On today's show, a new study shows poverty increasing in the metro area, particularly in the suburbs. Hear about the latest local food trend, foraging for weeds in sidewalk cracks. Oh yeah. Plus, fishermen who've been making a living selling paddlefish eggs as caviar have hit a major snag.
Well, we're now having to come back to these individuals and say, well, we're sorry, you know, your fish are ready to go, but we can't afford to harvest them.
And to kick off our series on KC's creative couples, listen to the troubled love story that sparked the idea.
In some ways, I think that Rivera almost encouraged Kahlo herself to become a work of art.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Since 2000, poverty in the metro area has increased by 75%. A quarter of the population is currently uninsured or on Medicaid, and the number of elderly people in the area will double in the next three decades. Those are just a few of the findings in a new regional health assessment produced by the Mid-America Regional Council. The report looks at health data for our area from 2000 to 2011 and offers a forecast of what's in the future for health in Kansas City. To hear more about the implications of these findings, KC Currents' Alex Smith spoke with Mark's Dean Katterndahl, who explained that some traditionally urban problems have been spreading.
The poverty rate has been increasing in the metropolitan area, and generally it's especially been increasing in suburban areas. So there's sort of a suburbanization of poverty. And this is kind of a national trend, not just a Kansas City metro trend, but we're definitely seeing it here. And so poverty rates have gone up. Generally, the poverty rates for the metropolitan area are somewhat below the national average, but we're sort of closing that gap over the last 10 or 11 years. And of course, over the recession, the poverty rate went up even higher.
The report says that about a quarter of the population in our area is either uninsured or on Medicaid, and that number has increased. Why have those numbers gone up?
One particular reason is the recession. We could see that increase starting in 2007, 2008, and so that's contributed to this. You can see that the number of folks or the percentage of folks that have health insurance through an employer dropped by 5%, and the number of folks who are uninsured or Medicaid went up. And you can just see these transfers. People with decent incomes lost their jobs, their incomes went down, and they lost their health insurance, and the only place they could turn was either Medicaid, usually for their children, or to be uninsured.
Now, the report talks a lot about the medically vulnerable. How much does race or ethnicity play into medical vulnerability?
Well, it does play a considerable role. There's quite a bit of correlation between poverty and race and medical outcomes. So you can see communities that have lower incomes or are predominantly people of color tend to have poor health outcomes. So the kind of two differentiations we saw were urban, low-income people of color, where there were worse health outcomes, and then rural areas where you have less access to medical care, fewer doctors per person and that, and also higher elderly population. So they would have 16% of their population would be older adults, where the more urban areas might be 10 or 11%. So that's going to cause some problems as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, it looks like on some health measures like obesity, our area is doing better than most of the country. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, while some of the demographic and economic trends are concerning, like the rise in poverty, on health measures, the region doesn't do that bad for obesity and diabetes. Our rates are somewhat below the national average. Now, the concerning part about obesity and diabetes in particular is that in every county, all 11 counties that we looked at, the diabetes rate and the obesity rate are increasing between 2002 and 2009. And so we're closing that gap. We do better than the national average, but we're closing that gap. And so that was one health area that we pointed out was of concern. But in some other areas, our death rates from cancer and heart disease, which are still the leading causes of death, have declined, some pretty large, some smaller. Something called preventable hospitalizations. These are reasons that you go to the hospital that could be prevented if you managed your health better, like diabetes or something is a preventable chronic disease. If you manage it well, you don't have to go to the hospital. Those preventable hospitalizations have gone down over a period of time in almost every county. So we're doing a better job of managing our health issues. And so those were some more positive trends.
Now, the report also looks at aging. What are the trends for aging, and how do they affect healthcare?
Well, we're just entering a period when we're going to have a rapid growth in older adult population over the age of 65. All the baby boomers are going to start getting older and retiring. And so we estimate that in the next 20 to 30 years, the older adult population will almost double, go up from about 11% of our population to about 19% of our population. And so how their health care is managed and issues such as Alzheimer's and that now become a bigger concern. You also have, so all these people are going to be on Medicare, so how is the health insurance system going to manage this? How's the health care system going to manage this? It's going to add a lot of complexity to health care in the future, and is a really major, significant trend.
Is there any evidence of how the Affordable Care Act might be affecting health trends in our area, or is it too soon to say?
It's probably too soon. We did point out that's a whole change in the landscape, and so how all this factors out with the Affordable Care Act is going to be important. There's already been quite a few changes as how safety net health services are provided, that there's some more money going into federally qualified health care providers like SWOP and Sam Rogers. Some of the free health care clinics, which serve those who are uninsured, have had to change their model to serve those who are on Medicaid. A lot of the Affordable Care Act was premised on that states would increase the amount of folks on Medicaid, and those extra funds would end up going to hospitals and going to clinics and would help pay for the care for these folks that are at the lowest end of our income spectrum. Well, neither Kansas nor Missouri did increase the coverage for Medicaid, and so those people are going to stay uninsured, and yet they're still going to need health care. They're going to go to hospitals and emergency rooms, and they're going to go to the clinics, but the clinics aren't going to get paid for them because they're not going to get this Medicaid. And so that's going to be an issue. How are those folks going to be cared for? What's the impact going to be on the hospitals and the clinics that provide care for them? So I think that's one of the big questions. I think another question is, will a lot of these people, like, for example, I mentioned that a lot of the people that were uninsured were adult working age, and over half of them were already employed. They're supposed to get insurance through these exchanges. So will they? How will that work? And then where will they where will I take that insurance for care, and are the clinics geared up to see these folks, and where are they getting care now, and how is that going to change?
Of course, when you published the first report, we were still in the middle of the recession, and that has now officially ended. I wonder if the improvement in the economy has made any significant changes in health, in just the well-being of the area.
I think it's a little early to tell. Our data only goes through 2011, so if we were recovered, it was just very modestly recovered. And so I think the next time we do the report, presumably in a couple of years, then we'll be able to see whether things that were dipping down are now coming back up. I mean, I know from other studies Mark does, not the health study, but looking at employment and that we are recovering, but it is a slow recovery. And so I think the impact on a lot of these folks, the folks that lost their employment, lost their health insurance, they're probably still a lot of them feeling that and haven't recovered yet.
Dean Katterndahl, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Happy to do it.
Dean Katterndahl is the Government Innovations Forum Director for the Mid-America Regional Council. He's one of the authors of the Kansas City Regional Health Assessment, which was prepared for the REACH Healthcare Foundation. He spoke to Casey Current's Alex Smith. Coming up, fishermen and paddlefish ranchers from around the region have been making a bundle selling caviar overseas, but their livelihood is now being threatened by a nearby competitor. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is away this week. The American paddlefish is a pretty bizarre-looking creature. It's aptly named because of the long, flat appendage jutting out of its head. The prehistoric species is native to North America, but it's developed a worldwide reputation for its caviar. And in between the rivers and five-star restaurants, the eggs pass through fish houses run by a unique group of American fishermen who, decades ago, threw out their nets to catch a piece of this lucrative market. But in recent years, those in the industry are facing an unexpected competitor and are now finding it more and more difficult to make a living off of this domestic delicacy. Casey Current's Ryan Schisler has the story.
Pull off Highway 54 in the Ozark town of Osage Beach, Missouri, and you'll find a small fish farm that's made a big name for itself. From the massive tanks in their building, Osage Cat Fisheries has supplied fish for research around the world. They've stocked the displays at Bass Pro Shops around the country. They've even sold some of the first farm-raised caviar this side of Russia.
This is my dad's dream, and we're trying to fulfill it.
Steve Kars runs Osage Cat Fisheries with his brothers. Their late father, Jim, got into the caviar business in the 80s after seeing headlines that the sturgeon in the Caspian Sea, where caviar traditionally came from, were nearing extinction and catching the fish was banned. The demand for new sources of caviar, like paddlefish eggs, skyrocketed. The Kars then started what they call the Paddlefish Ranching Program to snag a piece of the action.
We have a reputation invested in it with the people who are in our ranching program because, you know, of course, these people entered into our program, you know, thinking there'd be some return.
The ranchers are Missouri landowners who have lakes or ponds on their land. They allow Osage Cat Fisheries to raise its paddlefish on their land for free, and in exchange, they get a cut of the revenues from the resulting caviar sales. But recently, there's been a problem.
Well, we're now having to come back to these individuals and say, well, we're sorry, you know, your fish are ready to go, but we can't afford to harvest them.
Female paddlefish produce the most eggs when they're between 10 and 12 years old, so Kars made his investment in raising paddlefish over a decade ago. That's called the biological lag factor, how long you have to wait to harvest after the initial investment. Kars assumed, or hoped, that the market would stay the same after they invested. But something changed since then, and Kars is pointing his finger at a neighboring state. In the small Route 66 town of Miami, Oklahoma, Brent Gordon is loading small white boxes into a freezer truck behind the Paddlefish Research Center. Inside is frozen caviar, about 1,000 pounds worth, bound for a storage facility in Tulsa. But Gordon says the caviar isn't the main focus of his work at the Paddlefish Research Center.
The true beauty and purpose of this is to conserve the paddlefish.
The Paddlefish Research Center is a project run by the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, and Gordon is the man in charge. He's a biologist who's been with the department for 25 years. Northeastern Oklahoma is pretty much paddlefish heaven. There are more here than any other place in the world. And Brent Gordon? Well, he's Oklahoma's paddlefish guy. He even has a paddlefish air freshener hanging off the mirror of his game warden truck. Paddlefish populations vary from region to region. In Canada, they've pretty much gone extinct. In places like Oklahoma, there seem to be tons. Regardless, they've been protected by both the Endangered Species Act and the Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species since 1992. It was to protect Oklahoma's paddlefish population that Gordon helped open the research center in 2008.
And the idea was that not only have you created an operation in which it pays for itself to research the paddlefish population, but you've also created a way of getting revenue to pay for the toys that law enforcement needs, such as night vision, boats, trailers, and also being able to have money to pay for thermal imaging, flying over the lake at night, things like that.
It's essentially illegal for individuals to possess paddlefish eggs in Oklahoma, and you absolutely cannot sell them. Commercial production of caviar existed in the state in the 80s, but now the Department of Wildlife Conservation is the only entity that can sell it. Anything else is considered poaching. And that's where the Paddlefish Research Center comes in. During the couple months the center is open, recreational anglers that have paid the state for a fishing permit and catch paddlefish can bring their fish to the research center. There, the program will fillet the fish, package the meat, and dispose of the carcass for free. In exchange, Gordon and his team collect enormous amounts of data on the fish for research purposes, as well as the roe, or raw eggs. The center then turns the eggs into caviar, sells it on the international market, and the revenues go back to the Department of Wildlife Conservation.
Managing the population of paddlefish in Oklahoma is what we are paid to do, and we do it very well.
This year, the program sold over 15,000 pounds of caviar. It's a pretty average haul for the program that can bring in up to $2 million annually. They sold it anywhere between $65 a pound and $135 a pound, mostly to buyers in Japan. But back in Osage Beach, Steve Kars says that is where his problems begin.
I mean, there's no way a private company our size can compete with that kind of volume and that kind of price.
To be profitable, Kars will have to sell his caviar at $300 a pound. The rate in recent years has been as low as 60. He says Osage cat fisheries would actually lose money if it harvested the paddlefish today.
We don't have the luxury of cutting prices, and quite frankly, I'm not going to play that game. It's hard to compete with, cheap product.
Since Oklahoma anglers fish on their own dime and for fun, the state's program doesn't front the cost of raising or catching the fish, which is why their price is so low. They essentially get their supply of eggs for free when the fish are being brought to the center, while producers like Kars have been putting money and resources into raising paddlefish for over a decade and made that investment years before Oklahoma's program even existed. But it could be worse, and Kars knows that.
Thank God we've got other companies like the farming operation that is, making money. Because if we were in the caviar business like some of these commercial fishermen, the caviar season is what gets them through the year. And, with the prices that are out there, they won't make it. Absolutely no way they can make it.
Those commercial fishermen make up most of the paddlefish caviar producers. They fish season to season for wild fish in the region's rivers and face a different set of costs. Fuel for their boats, fishing supplies, fishing permit applications, maintenance, salaries. The list goes on and on.
You can't contend with a state. An individual just cannot contend or compete with a state.
That's Jesse George, a caviar producer in Marvell, Arkansas. He's seen his prices drop $35 a pound this year alone, about 30%. He says he's one of the largest producers in the state of Arkansas, but even he can only produce a fraction of Oklahoma's annual output. I spoke to him and several others across the country, from Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky. Some even dispute the claim that paddlefish are endangered at all and think that Oklahoma's program is irrelevant. They say they all have the same story. Prices are falling, expenses are rising. One man I spoke to in Indiana says his fishermen used to make up to $30,000 in one paddlefish season. Now they're lucky to make it to 15. Another said he had to let go of 13 fishermen in the past 2 years and now only employs three. Yet another said he had to lower his prices an additional 25% below Oklahoma's just to find a buyer. Though they know Oklahoma isn't the only factor causing this. The global recession has had a significant effect on their market, but when they talk to buyers, Oklahoma's prices keep coming up, and they say the state is taking their business away. Joe Parcell is a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Missouri. He agrees that the recession affected the price of caviar, but he also says it's easy to saturate the market of a luxury product, like caviar. When demand is so low to begin with, and a producer like Oklahoma is putting a comparatively massive amount of product on the market at a low price, there will be a ripple effect.
Obviously, whenever you have one entity that comes in and has a significantly reduced price, they're going to drive the price down for everyone that's in that market.
But at the end of the day, private producers like Steve Carrs are upset about who they're competing against and the unfair advantages they say Oklahoma has.
It all boils down to the fact is that I hate seeing, and I think a lot of people say, seeing a government agency go up against private industry. I mean, our family's been in this business a long time. We're not looking for any special favors. We built everything we've got.
Back in Oklahoma, Brent Gordon of the Paddlefish Research Center says it was never about competition and disagrees with claims that his program is significantly affecting the market. For him, the caviar is just a means to an end. His job, first and foremost, is about taking care of Oklahoma's paddlefish, and he says this program has given him an unprecedented advantage in his research and conservation efforts.
Our biggest concern, not our only concern, but our biggest concern has to do with keeping this population healthy. And not only just this population, but other populations of paddlefish in the state of Oklahoma.
Private caviar producers may be catching a break soon, though. Gordon says his data is indicating that Oklahoma's paddlefish population may need some time to rest, so to speak, and that discussions to cap the number of fishing permits issued in 2015 are ongoing. For Casey Currents, I'm Ryan Schisler.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, you can catch whatever you miss online in our audio archives. That's at kcur.org. Or subscribe to the podcast and never miss a show. Find us on iTunes. Did that story about paddlefish caviar make you hungry? Well, here's an even more local alternative. Just turn to a crack in the sidewalk or that abandoned lot next to the post office. Some urban Americans are taking the term locavore to a whole new level, or actually a really old level. Reporting from Nebraska for Harvest Public Media, Hillary Stose-Krause has more.
It's a chilly, humid, windy day in southeast Nebraska. I'm out hunting for morels with Adam Hintz, a forager from Lincoln. Morels, which kind of look like shrunken brains, are an elusive mushroom. So far, we haven't had much luck. We have seen a slew of other edible wild plants, though. Everything from dandelions to milkweed to nettles.
This is a common milkweed. You can eat it in three different forms throughout the year.
Lots of attention over the past few years has been given to programs like community gardens or community-supported agriculture, where you pay so much money per month for a box of food straight from a nearby farm. But some urban dwellers, like coffee shop owner Hintz, seek out more rogue food sources. Hintz is an avid forager, or someone who harvests uncultivated food, like acorns that fall along the bike path, crab apples on a park tree, or dandelions growing in the backyard. On this particular day, we come upon some Solomon seal, a tall, leafy plant with tiny white flowers. Hintz pulls out the stalk to get to the roots.
So I'm going to try to eat this. We're going to see what happens, because I've never tried it before. And it tastes good. It tastes kind of like a potato, which would make sense since it's a tuber. You just take a little bit. If you feel any numbing or anything like that, spit it out right away, you know?
That's one of the main risks when it comes to foraging, Hintz says. You never know how your body will react to something. He recommends trying a tiny amount to start, and if everything goes well, a slightly larger amount. Then wait 24 hours before eating more, just to be sure. He says you also have to be careful about imitators. poisonous plants that resemble nutritious plants. Taking an edible food guide along when you go foraging will help keep you safe. Another Lincoln forager, Dustin Rimpf, seconded that advice, because one time he mixed up chestnuts with horse chestnuts.
They make you puke and are toxic enough to make you feel bad for quite a long time.
At this point, you might be thinking, dandelions? Nettles? Ew. You're not alone, Rimpf says with a laugh.
Usually people are pretty grossed out. To be fair, I've made some really gross meals with the stuff I brought home in my day, and that's another thing, is learning how to prepare it in a way that's good, just like you would any other food. If you, you know, put a raw potato on a plate, people are going to be like, that's really gross. But if you cook up a potato really well, people think it's delicious.
Rimpf's goal is to eat one wild thing each day. And even though he lives right near downtown Lincoln, he says it's not that hard.
Oh, I mean, there are all kinds of delicious things that grow in sidewalk cracks. Anybody in a concrete jungle can find plenty of food.
That food is all around us message resonates with Dan Sussman. He's the director and producer of Growing Cities, a soon-to-be-released documentary looking at urban agriculture. He and his crew visited about 20 cities and 80 different urban farmers across the country.
I think people are becoming a lot more aware about the connections to food and health. So there's been things like Michael Pollan with the Omnivore's Dilemma and Food Inc., and people often cite those types of things that have really reached more of a mainstream group to kind of make people more aware.
Sussman points out that there's also a very practical advantage with urban food production and foraging. Growing your own food, or simply picking it off the ground, can save you a lot of money. But it depends on the state. In Kansas, for example, you're free to take what you want from state parks, and Oregon's park system actually offers guided tours to foraging. In California, on the other hand, unapproved removal of plants from public land can result in jail time. In the end, it takes practice, forager Justin Rimpf says. Every year, he learns more and more about what tastes good, when and where to find it, and how to prepare it.
I think mulberries are delicious. I love using wild plums and crab apples of certain kinds. Cress this year, I finally found cress early enough.
It might not be for everyone, but for some, it's a way of life. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Hillary Stowes Krause.
We're pretty spoiled when it comes to public libraries in the Kansas City area, but in rural parts of Missouri and Kansas, it's not so easy to check out a book or find a story hour for your kids. Just north of the Missouri-Arkansas state line, on a country highway, there's a quaint stone building that locals say dates back to the Works Progress Administration. And inside is one woman who sees herself as a curator. KSMU's Jennifer Davidson has this profile of a small-town librarian in Oregon County in southern Missouri.
Rachel Reynolds Luster has a new job. She's the only librarian at the cozy one-room library in Myrtle, Missouri, population around 150. There's one gas station and a small post office, but no grocery store or bank. Upon reporting to work on day one, she realized there was going to be one major challenge. There were hardly any modern books.
The librarian before me really liked paperback romance novels, and so we have lots of those. It's about a third of our library inventory.
Nor could Luster see any works from the other end of the literary timeline. She set out to find the one book she thought all libraries should have, the Greek epic, The Odyssey.
And I looked, and we didn't have one. No library in our system had one. So I just got that and processed it today. And so I'm excited to be able to put that, you know, on the shelf.
The librarian before her, whom Luster praises for keeping this little haven of literature alive, worked here for nearly four decades and still considers it her baby. She stops by nearly every day, Luster says.
It's been interesting working this transition with her. She was quite upset that the cooking magazines were gone, but we recycled them all. And we kept some holiday cookie editions.
Luster has a vision for this library and for the community that frequents it. She wants to transform it into a vibrant place of community and learning. It's one of the few places that can even get broadband internet in this county. And before Luster came, the Myrtle Library only had 2 story times a year. She wants that to become a weekly event.
There are quite a few kids in the area, and there's just not a whole lot to do other than going to the river or hanging out with friends and family. There's not public activities. We don't have a movie store. We don't have parks. We don't have a lot of public spaces.
You said that the children's books here are pretty outdated. Can you give me an example? Can you show me where those are?
I can. I started in the library business. We call it weeding. And so I went through a pile, but let's see if I can find the one that was of particular interest to me. Oh, here we go. We had a series of Ewok books from Return of the Jedi, which I am familiar with because I was a child in the early 80s, but I can't imagine that they would have a lot of resonance with young people today.
This one over here, this one almost looks like it's from the 50s, this one here.
Oh, yeah, we do. And I kept some of the 50s books because there's some really classic ones like The Little Engine That Could and things. But yeah, this one is Sam's Country, a small town in the Midwest, and it's describing a small town. Actually, it looks like a rather large town compared to where we live.
She does have a budget from Oregon County. It's $200 a month. But that covers all books, magazines, and activities.
Like a Friends of the Library in a city can crank out money fairly easily. We're not in that situation here.
There's a tiny 7-foot-wide section for adult nonfiction, but about half of that consists of cookbooks from the 1980s. Another challenge she anticipates is finding actual space to put the new books in.
You really have to pick and curate and think, okay, so if I'm going to have one Brooks Blevins book, or if I'm about Ozark culture, if I'm going to have one Don Harrington novel or Daniel Woodrell novel, what should it be, you know?
Luster spent time studying in New York City. She has 2 master's degrees, and before long, she'll be able to scribble PhD after her name. She says she feels a very strong responsibility to use whatever talents or skills she has to make the resources in her community the strongest they can be. For KSMU News, I'm Jennifer Davidson.
After the break, the turbulent love story of Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera kicks off our series on Kansas City's creative couples. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. This summer, Kansas City has been plastered with the iconic image of Mexican painter Frida Kahlo. That's because of the Modern Mexico exhibit at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. The centerpiece of the exhibit, which is based on the collection of Jacques and Natasha Gelman, is a set of paintings by Kahlo and her husband, Diego Rivera. Theirs was one of the art world's great and greatly troubled marriages, and made us here at Casey Currents start thinking about Kansas City's artistic partnerships. Over the next month, we'll be airing a special series profiling KC's creative couples. This week, we'll learn more about the 2 artists who inspired the series. I stopped by the Nelson to talk to curator Stephanie Knapp about the relationship between Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera and how it influenced their work.
Some biographers say that Kahlo and Rivera met when Kahlo was a student and Rivera was painting murals at the National Preparatory School. And so the legend goes, Kahlo was quite the prankster, and she would glue Rivera's lunchbox shut. She ran around with a gang of students who reportedly would set fire to some of the muralist scaffolding. She would call out to him, you know, Diego, watch out, so-and-so's coming, that so-and-so being one of his secret lovers when he'd be walking through the school with one of his girlfriends. Others say that they met when they were attending rallies of the Communist Party, and still others say that they met when there was a party thrown by the photographer Tina Modotti, and Rivera was there and shot his pistol at a phonograph, and Kahlo saw that and was immediately attracted and scared of this man. But more close to the official story is when Rivera was painting murals again at the National Preparatory School, and Kahlo came to him to get opinions about her art. So she called to him when he was up on his scaffolding and said, come down here, look at my paintings. I'm not here to flirt with you. And that caught his attention.
Interesting, because then the relationship went on. And she was quite a bit younger than him.
Yes, he was 20 years older than she was.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, how did they interact as artists then? And how did the relationship develop in that way?
Well, they were both very supportive of each other's art. In some ways, I think that Rivera almost encouraged Kahlo herself to become a work of art. It was after they were married in 1929 that she started dressing in indigenous attire, braiding her hair in the elaborate manners, wearing the garments of the women of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. So she becomes a work of art herself. He's encouraging her to paint. You know, she didn't have formal training. He's encouraging her. She's also encouraging him. And they both embrace Mexicanidad, or a reassessment and a reappreciation of Mexico and its traditions and culture that a whole generation of artists, thinkers, musicians, and writers embraced in the early 20th century in Mexico.
And they're known for somewhat different kinds of work, although there are clearly some similarities. Diego Rivera was known for these large political murals, and Frida for smaller, these iconic self-portraits showing her gritty endurance of physical and emotional pain. I wonder how you characterize their different works.
I think you have the very publicly minded Diego Rivera, again, painting some 4,000 square meters worth of murals in Mexico and in the United States, murals that are about chronicling the history of Mexico, the history of its people, and then, as you said, the very personal, private reflections of self by Frida Kahlo. And you can look at again and again, she's returning to the same subject matter, but it's never boring, never predictable, just like Rivera's murals. But at the heart of both of their art is, again, this deep love and passion for Mexico. In the collection of the Gelmans that's at the Nelson Atkins this summer, I'd say the most iconic work is Diego on My Mind. So there you get the 1-2 punch, both of our headliners in a single portrait. It's painted in 1943 by Frida Kahlo. And you have Kahlo, who is dressed in the traditional wedding attire of the women of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. This is a matriarchal society. So you see her wearing this very elaborate, lacy headdress, and literally imposed on her forehead is Diego Rivera. And to me, that's a perfect example of just how close these two artists were, even though the stories of their very tempestuous relationship is well known. But at the same time, they're both such a force in each other's lives. And you see that in that portrait, which I would say is probably the most iconic in the collection.
And is that Diego on her forehead? Is that a demonstration of love? Is it an obsession?
Some say love, some say entrapment. You'll see that in that portrait, she's wearing, again, that very elaborate wedding headdress, and the threads of that headdress are intertwined with the roots of her floral headdress, and some say that those start to look like the intricate web of a spider, and she's, you know, trapped Diego Rivera. But again, it could be obsession, it could be great love. He's also shown on her forehead in the position of the third eye, so a symbol of clairvoyance or wisdom, so almost a guiding force and factor in her art.
The other painting in the collection that has the two of them that she made is of her embracing him, his naked body, and he almost looks like he has breasts in the portrait. And then she, in turn, is being embraced by a larger sort of, I don't know, deity or something?
Exactly. That's the love embrace of the universe. So picture that was painted in the late 1940s, and you have, as you said, Frida Kahlo cradling her Dieguito, her baby, Diego Rivera, with a man's head but a baby's plump, chubby body. And she would often call Diego Rivera my child, my lover, and my universe. So she is cradling him, and you'll see that he has the third eye again on his forehead this time. She, as you said, is in turn being held and embraced by a symbol of Mexico. And Mexico, its fertile soil, is giving life to various cacti. Mexico is also becoming a wet nurse for both Kahlo and Rivera, symbolically nourishing them as artists. And Mexico, Rivera, and Kahlo are in turn embraced by the universe. So this is a picture of Mexico, of the complicated relationship of Kahlo and Rivera, and how it's all united by the universe.
How does gender play into this, those portraits particularly, but also the type of paintings that each of them did?
I'm not sure if it's necessarily a factor of strictly gender. Kahlo painting smaller easel pictures that had a lot to do with the circumstances of her life, you know, at the age of 6 being diagnosed with polio, having a withered right leg as a result. Then in 1925, the terrible accident where the bus she was riding on was hit by a tram and the multiple surgeries that she had to endure after that. So she was often bedridden, had many, many surgeries throughout her life, and was often confined to a wheelchair. So by necessity, she was painting smaller pictures, whereas Rivera could take on, you know, these large-scale mural projects.
And their relationship seems to have been a major subject of hers. Did it appear in his painting?
The struggles may not have appeared in his painting to the same degree that they would appear in hers. With Kahlo, you have pictures that she painted after their divorce, where suddenly she has clipped her hair short, showing herself in men's clothing, you know, bits of hair all around her feet. She also then, once they were reunited and remarried in 1940, she suddenly has long hair once again, exuberantly braided on top of her head, you know, the symbol of femininity. But for Rivera, the one picture that I think of is a lithograph that he made of Kahlo, and it's a nude, a very sensual nude that does not show a single mark of the physical trauma that she endured in her life. It is a very idealized nude, I think, shown through very, very loving eyes, but created at a time when their relationship was actually quite rocky. Both of them engaged in a number of affairs.
And I was going to bring that up. And, you know, there's sort of maybe a stereotype that artist types are known to have more open concept of relationships, and maybe they're less constrained by societal mores. I wonder, Frida and Diego both had affairs. Diego with her sister, among others, and Frida famously with the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky. How did they see fidelity?
That's quite the story. So Rivera actually went to his doctor, asking the doctor to please write some kind of, not a prescription, but some kind of note that would excuse him from being faithful, saying that it was physically impossible for Diego Rivera to remain faithful to anyone. So he was looking for any kind of excuse to continue on with his affairs. He never felt like he needed to hide his affairs at all. By the time that Kahlo and Rivera married in 1929, he had already been married 3 times, had 3 children on 2 continents. He was always a great lover of women, even when he was married to someone else. Kahlo, at the same time, had a number of affairs, as you mentioned, and she was a little more discreet with her love affairs, and she was involved with men and women. Reportedly, Rivera didn't mind her affairs with women as much as he minded her affairs with men. And you mentioned the affair that Kahlo had with Leon Trotsky. That's one that some of Kahlo's biographers have said that was very calculated on her behalf, because Trotsky had come seeking asylum in Mexico and had actually lived in the same home as Kahlo and Rivera. And Rivera and Trotsky were great friends. So some have wondered if that was a little bit of revenge for the affair that Rivera had with her own sister, Cristina.
I read that she once said, "I do not think the banks of a river suffer by letting the water run," which implies that she that's part of love. But on the other hand, her paintings seem to indicate that it did bother her.
Right, and she also famously said that, "I endured 2 great accidents in my life, the bus accident and Diego Rivera. Of those 2 accidents, Diego Rivera was by far the worst."
I wonder if people who study this era of Mexican painting sometimes end up kind of siding with one or the other, either personally or because of their art.
Goodness. I think Frida Kahlo has risen to be such a feminist icon that you may have many people today siding with her. Some people have gone about, "Oh, you know, poor Kahlo, you know, Rivera ran all around town with everyone." But then it's interesting when they start to hear the way that Frida Kahlo lived her life and how that can sometimes change their poor Frida opinions. The Gelmans did not collect any of the art that showed the suffering Kahlo, the traumas of her life. Instead, they collected self-portraits that show her as a very strong, very confident woman. So that's when I say that her art could almost be a self-protective measure, almost the same way as the clothing styles that she adopted, the long skirts to cover her withered leg, you know, underneath those clothes, the corsets that held her upright later in her life. I think sometimes she's using her painting almost as the same armor as she does her clothes and her fashion.
Do you happen to know if they had any domestic sort of rituals or routines that sort of had to do with their creative life?
Gosh, I don't know. You know, we have in the exhibition a few photographs that show Kahlo working, and it's very interesting to see Rivera over her shoulder. In the 1930s, Rivera commissioned a home from Juan O'Gorman to be created for them, and there was one large structure that was his home. Kahlo had a smaller home, but they were connected by a bridge. So to me, that is a great metaphor for their marriage and for their relationship, these two very powerful, influential, creative figures that could exist on their own, but they were always connected, whether it's through that bridge, through their art, through their passion for Mexico. That always endured, and that seems to be symbolized in that home.
Interesting, but they had their separate spaces.
Exactly, exactly.
One of the themes of Frida's work and life is that she never had children and she wanted to, and that their relationship didn't bear children.
Well, yes. Kahlo endured a number of miscarriages, you know, stemming back to that terrible accident in 1925. And whether or not she really was deeply, deeply distressed about the fact that she wasn't able to have children is something that is currently under contention. You'll have some biographers that were saying that, no, this was just such a terrible point of depression in her life because she could not give Rivera a child. And others have said, no, she actually did not want to be a mother. So don't read those sorts of maternal desires into her art. You have Frida Kahlo dying in 1954. Diego Rivera reportedly turned old overnight after she died. He mourned her for about a year, but then, as was his tendency, remarried. But at the end of his life, it was his wish that after he died, that their ashes would be commingled. And unfortunately, that never happened. Her ashes are in the museum that Rivera created out of the Casa Azul, the Blue House in Mexico City. And he is in the rotunda of distinguished men in Mexico City. So despite this wish that they be together in death, unfortunately, that never happened. But to me, that's telling that even though Rivera would remarry after Kahlo's death, and even though their marriage suffered under great strain, that passion endured and there was a desire to always be together.
Stephanie Knapp is curator of the Modern Mexico exhibit featuring the work of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, among others, at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
The exhibit, Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and Masterpieces of Modern Mexico, runs through August 18th at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Our series about Kansas City's creative couples begins next week. We end this week's show with music from a band out of Lawrence, Kansas, called Cowboy Indian Bear. Their second full-length album, Live Old, Die Young, was released earlier this year. The four-member group first came together in 2008 and signed with the Kansas City label The Record Machine in 2010. Here's a single off their most recent album, Does Anybody See You Out?
You're listening to Does Anybody See You Out from local band Cowboy Indian Bears album released back in April. It's called Live Old, Die Young. That's it for Casey Currents this week. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org. You can check out individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents. Our associate producer is Alex Smith. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky and Ryan Schisler. The music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson will be back with me next week.